Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to Community Conversations here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler. Today's interview is with a brand new local author, Mindy Cameron, who tells us about her new book, Leaving the Boys, a story of motherhood and career, feminism and romance. It's her memoir about her life as a mother and the conflicting choices she faced to pursue her career as a professional journalist. It recounts just how far the gender roles have come for women. Plus, it's a story that winds up right here in Sam. And it's very well written, of course, as Mindy's had a fine career as a journalist. We'll be talking with her in just a moment. But first, here are a few words about this show. We air Community Conversations every Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. with recorded interviews on local issues. Plus, there's a podcast of each show that's available after airtime on our website at www.krfy.org. Community Conversations is actually just a stand-in for the live morning show that formerly aired at this time. We intend for the morning show to come back once we get past the coronavirus precautions that have closed our studio for live interviews. That still remains uncertain, unfortunately, due to the rising cases here. But this is just to say that the morning show will be back. So with that, let's get on with today's interview. Mindy Cameron, thanks for talking with us today.
Hi, Chris.
So our subject today is your new book, Leaving the Boys, which is a very personal memoir about your decisions balancing motherhood with your two sons against your professional career. And this at a time in the 1960s and early 70s when for many women it was pretty much an either-or decision. And we'll get into that because it's got a lot of interesting cultural revelations, I think. But first, to give our listeners a framework, let's learn a little bit more about you. You've lived in Sandpoint now for almost 20 years, and you've been involved in community affairs. You helped found the Panhandle Alliance for Education, and you served on the school board for 11 years. So I think a lot of people here know you, but give us the short story on your biography and how you landed in Sandpoint.
Well, as the book recounts, I fell into journalism in high school and liked writing, and that got me to college. And I always thought of myself probably as winding up being a journalist. That was what seemed the most obvious. And it after some early marriage because of an unwanted pregnancy and all of that, that's covered in the book. I did find my way back to journalism, and kind of it all happened first at the Lewiston Tribune, that really gave me my first shot, and it's a wonderful small newspaper, and it was just a wonderful start. And then I went to Boise from there to the Idaho Statesman, and then into public television in Boise for a couple of years, where I met Bill, my husband now, and I had been recently divorced because the book subtitle is Motherhood and Career, Feminism and Romance. So romance is part of the story, and Bill is the romantic interest to, which may be surprising to some people. And then it became a pattern of finding jobs together. And that's the leaving the boys part was when I left Boise and the boys stayed with their father, my ex-husband, Ken Cameron, and went to Rochester, New York. And I had a job there, got a job there, and Bill had a job there too. So that's when that all started. And then I wound, I just couldn't stand being away. Rochester's not a really charming spot. The job was fine, but I really didn't want to be that far away from the boys. So I got a job back at the Lewiston Tribune, fortunately, as managing editor, and was there for 2 years, and then kind of fell in at a conference in Seattle, met some Seattle Times editors, all males, and this was like in the early 80s. And pretty soon I had an interview request. They had asked me to come for an interview and offered me a job. So I moved again, and then Bill was left. Anyway, it was complicated trying to keep our lives together. But we finally did wind up in Seattle together. But we found ourselves coming back to Sandpoint, where we had vacationed at a friend's cabin on Bottle Bay. And so that became, through all those Seattle years, Seattleites don't understand that. They think Seattle's the center of the universe and all wonderful things can happen there. And it's a wonderful place, but we were very drawn to the Bottle Bay area and Sandpoint. And so that was always a goal, which became much more important to us as we spent, you know, 20 years in Seattle. So I decided I'm leaving. Bill had gotten his law degree and was practicing law, And we decided that we then could, I could just quit working and move to Sandpoint and have the life we wanted here. So we did. And here we are.
That was just about 20 years ago, almost.
Almost exactly 20 years ago.
Yeah. Right? So maybe you can call yourself a local?
I think of myself as a local. I mean, the real locals like you, Chris, probably wouldn't accept me as a local, but I'm a longtime newcomer, I could say.
Yeah, I don't know what it takes to be considered a local, but it's a secret formula of some sort. Yeah. Well, so I'll say that when you first told me about your book, I thought it would be focused on being a professional woman in an era when working women were just starting to break out of gender stereotypes. And it would be really focused on breaking the glass ceiling. And of course, there's a strong element of that in this book. But the story you tell here is a lot more personal than that. It's right there in the title, Leaving the Boys. And that's the main event you write about in the book. It opens with what was a pretty wrenching decision for you. And I think you made this decision in 1976 to leave your boys, your sons, your two sons, with your ex-husband and move back east for a career opportunity, as well as to further your relationship with your current husband now, Bill. And that's Bill Berg, we should mention, in case somebody doesn't know that. And he's an attorney here in town, also well known here in Sandpoint. But can you fill us in on what was happening at that era of being a professional woman or trying to be a professional woman when you were trying to also be a mother?
Well, I try to sort of plant hints of this because as I was going along and discovered, and it really started at the Lewiston Tribune, my first job there in 1969, I think it was, I realized how much I loved being in the newsroom in that environment. And I that described in there a scene when Cecil Andrus showed up at the Lewiston Tribune office, and he's a very charming guy and kind of made a special effort. I felt like he'd made a special effort to talk to me. And I knew that, you know, he's a politician probably going somewhere. And I just thought, oh man, I love this. You know, I just love this whole environment. So I was kind of hooked. And I was working mostly nights there because Ken had his day job as an optometrist. And so it began this clash between finding the kind of journalism work that I wanted to do and taking care of these boys. And I realized kind of early on that the journalism work was a lot more satisfying, certainly intellectually satisfying and socially satisfying, the kind of people I was around, than taking care of two little boys. So I loved dearly, but it, you know, just didn't get the same kind of joy and satisfaction that the best mothers do. So that kind of set the pattern for trying always to work that out, and finally relying on my ex-husband to raise the boys for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm. I want to interject. Cecil Andrus was our former governor. He became Secretary of Interior, then he came back in to become a governor of Idaho again. So he's like one of the big shining stars of our political landscape here. And your ex-husband was Ken Cameron, who a lot of folks listening probably knew because mm-hmm. Ken moved up to Sandpoint, was optometrist here. Hey, he worked on my eyes.
Yeah, a lot of people I know do know and remember Ken fondly. Yeah. He was a great father, a good guy, and when we moved back here it was kind of just coincidental, actually, but we became, you know, we saw him a lot because the kids would visit and see all of us, and we had many parties together, you know, birthday events we'd celebrate with him at our Bottle Bay place, and so he became part of our summer life when the boys were around, and so we were, you know, very, very, you know, fond acquaintances, I'd say, and he died several years ago, and now we stay in touch and are friends with Gail, the woman he married.
Mm-hmm. His widow. So one of the things, I'll say this, you probably were eased in this decision because Ken was a very stand-up guy, and I'm sure he was a good father.
Yeah, no, I did. It made what, yeah, I couldn't have done it otherwise without him. He made it all possible. That doesn't mean that there's a lot of good fathers out there and mothers who may be a little wanting to get out, but they don't all make that step. So it was, and I didn't really, I mean, I in my mind, and I try to get to this in the book, in my mind, I was very rational about it. It was going to be fine because the kids weren't going to change school. They're going to be with their father in the same house, and it would all work out fine. And then I realized in the departure itself, in the next few days and weeks when I was back in Rochester, that there was a huge emotional component that I just had not prepared myself for. And it was very, became at that point pretty difficult. And the best part of my life then was Bill. We were getting along fine, and it sort of really solidified our relationship.
So one of the things that stand out for me in reading your book is this cultural shift that I mentioned earlier. Doing the math from the dates that you cite in your book, were you born in 1943?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So and you became pregnant with your first son in probably 64, 65.
65, 2 months before I was to graduate from college, and I had all kinds of dreams about doing other things than having a baby. Yeah.
Yeah, so and you described that whole kind of the shock and what you went through, and you basically eloped with Ken to get married, and kind of your folks were kind of disapproving or very disapproving of that. But you mentioned some things in that period of time, since 1965, that seem really remarkable now. And one is you mentioned you'd never heard of abortion.
I grew up in a family of all girls in a very, as I realize now, very sheltered environment, and just didn't know about those things. No.
And there was no pill available for birth control at that time.
Not that I was aware of, huh?
And I think you mentioned that even after that came on the scene, you women could not get a prescription for a birth control pill
That's
without
right.
if they were not unmarried.
That's right. Unmarried women, or even under unmarried women, it was illegal. Although I've subsequently talked to women who, as women, have always found ways around these things, and some found ways around them. But I was never, I just didn't know anything about how to do that. My only experiences was in high school, girls kind of disappeared and came back, and the gossip was that they'd had a baby and put it up for adoption. Well, I wasn't a high school kid anymore, and so the only thing I knew to do was bite the bullet and get married. So we did.
And you mentioned you had six sisters, a family
I
of
do.
seven daughters. Were you able to confide? You don't mention this in the book. Were you able to confide with any of your sisters on all this?
No, not no, not. I just wasn't. It wasn't that kind of a close family. I mean, we're close now, and we see a lot of each other and are in touch. But at that time, I was really the first one to go away to college, and it was just about getting away, being independent. And there weren't any rifts, but no, they were getting on with their lives and families. And no, I did not have any confidence.
And how old were the boys when you made that decision to move to the East Coast?
They were 8 and 11.
And they handled it a little differently, the two of them.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, the older son is, he just kind of rolls with the punches and is very, kind of self-confident. And Tim, the younger one, was very sensitive kid, ornery, stubborn, but sweet, and very lovable in his good times. and it was very hard for him. We had agreed to Sunday night phone calls, and the older boy, Matt, he didn't like to talk on the phone too much and didn't have much to say. But Tim would save things up through the week, so he'd have some stuff to talk to me about. It was very sweet, but early on, we both cried every Sunday night in those phone calls. So it was pretty hard.
And then you were actually only in New York for a couple of years.
Right. I was desperate to get back west.
And then you came back, and that seemed to kind of normalize the separation with your sons.
Well, it helped a lot. I was within distance where I could see them routinely on weekends, because by then Ken had moved to Sandpoint with the boys, And I was in Lewiston, so weekends were simple enough to get together. And summers, of course, spent a lot of time together. Yeah, it did. It normalized to us to a certain extent, as normal as it is for a mother to be the away parent.
Well, I will say that in this day and age, when there's an awful lot of divorce and separated parents like that, by the time you got back to the West Coast here, to Lewiston, it seems like that's kind of normal even now.
Yeah, it's certainly more normal now. It's not as unusual. The thing for me was, and I don't know, it goes back to, and I've written about this some, you've seen in the book, just how ashamed of myself I was. I thought of myself as an achiever, and I was going places, and I was so ashamed of this pregnancy and this early marriage. I didn't really talk about. I was embarrassed even as I went through my career to. For people to know that I was pregnant when I got married, and it was just, that's all different today. So different. But that's why I wrote about it very personally, because it was at least it was very different for me, and I really lived with that kind of shame of that for quite a while.
Yeah, it definitely comes through in the book. You're wrestling with that whole question of motherhood, and are you being a bad mother because you're also trying to pursue a professional career that's fulfilling for you? And I'm sure there are still women today, many women today, that have that same conflict.
Yeah, I've heard feedback from women and from some men too, who one guy who's kind of a friend of mine, but he said he could relate to the feminism thing. He said that the feminist issues are your issues and your story, but he can relate to it because was married twice. He had two wives and two daughters, and so he felt like he'd lived it from the other side. So it's interesting. Yeah, there's a lot that people relate to.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the professional side of it. I think you were the first woman to be managing editor at the Lewiston Morning Tribune.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's, I'm sure, breaking a glass ceiling right there.
A
And
little
we
one,
should
yeah.
I should say that the Lewiston Morning Tribune, at the time you were there, because I'm in journalism as well, my day job. Actually, I would have been in Bonner's Ferry as editor of the Bonner's Ferry Herald in 78 to 81, basically. And when were you in Lewiston?
That's about the time I was there. I was there 79 to 80, 81 or 78, sometime then.
Okay. But the Lewiston Morning Tribune was very much looked up to in the state as a newspaper of high integrity and really fulfilling the role of a small newspaper.
Yeah, I was just thrilled to be back there and have that opportunity. It was just really, and it was, I didn't, I figured that, and Bill got a job up in Moscow at the university. We just figured it was a chance we'd just stay there, and we could make a life there. And then things changed for both of us, actually. Unsuspecting changes came along.
Yeah, you mentioned that a little bit earlier, that you basically got an offer you couldn't refuse, I think, in Seattle.
Yeah. And for Bill, he was there in the 80s, and when Reagan was elected, a lot of things changed for public television funding, and sort of the floor fell out at KUID up in Idaho. And so he was looking for another job, and he'd already found one in commercial television in Yakima. I kind of didn't really want to go to Yakima. And so the Seattle thing came along, and there we were again, separate cities, and oh, it was really hard for him.
Yeah. But that didn't last that long either, because he was
No,
able
no. He's a
you
very
move yeah
persistent
you move
guy. He
yeah you moved over to the Seattle Times, and then he joined you in Seattle
That's
not too
right.
long after that. Yeah.
That's right, about 6 months later. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about the the gender stereotypes that you encountered working at the Seattle Times, much larger metro newspaper.
Well, I was hired, and I knew at the Times that they were trying to change from their reputation as a, Fairview Fannie is what it calls, stately, state you know, staid newspaper, not as lively as the PI, which was better known around the region, because Seattle Times is very much strictly a city and metropolitan newspaper. And so I was hired to be the first woman to work as in a management position in the newsroom. And it all seems odd today, but that's how it was. And there wasn't anything overt other than I do describe, you know, some episodes with my direct boss. I went in as assistant city editor and was working for a guy named Alex, and who'd been there a long time. His father had been there, so he was a fixture there. And he was, I just had the feeling that he wasn't on my side in the hiring decisions, and he was kind of tough, made it. And I'd never worked in that large an organization before and didn't get any orientation as that I can remember about, you know, this or that or our coverage range or that kind of thing. So it was kind of difficult for the first year or so, but I made friends and allies who appreciated the kinds of things I was doing and the fact that I was a woman in the newsroom with a title and supervisory role. And I think that made a difference to the women on the staff, the reporters on the staff. And I came to learn that and appreciated that.
You didn't smoke cigars and drink whiskey, though.
And no, not on the job. I did. I'm Scotch. Oh, now I'm a Jameson.
Oh, that's right. Scotch is your drink.
One time, Bottle Bay, vacationing with some friends, and somebody pulled out some of these little, you know, female size cigars, and I tried that.
So you were basically one of the first female news executives at the Seattle Times.
I was the first female news executive at the Seattle Times. And another woman was hired shortly after. And one of the feminine thing that, you know, the things that happen, the stereotypical things, there was this sort of undercurrent of thought, oh, how is this going to be for Mindy and this other woman who was hired not too long after me? Her name was Cindy, and she was in an executive position too. And the two women, you know, are they going to get along, you know, kind of thing. People were expecting cat fights or something. I don't know what, but it was just weird. And of course, it wasn't like that. We were colleagues and friends. And
yeah. Well, you're breaking new ground. So,
yeah, right.
And you were, I think, started there as an assistant city editor. And then you were kind of in charge of the city beat, but then you became the editorial page editor.
Yeah, I was assistant city editor. And then very shortly after that, after several months, became the city editor as my boss, Alex, had moved up into a managing editor position. So I did that for about 8 years. And then Frank Blethyn, the publisher, I think he decided he wanted to make some waves on the editorial page and have a woman there, which had, of course, never been done in Seattle. It was always led by kind of crusty old men who were very much insiders in the power structure in Seattle. So, I went on the editorial page, and I just, in a very short time, I just thought I'd died and gone to journalism heaven. I just absolutely loved that job. It's great.
So what's a day in the life of an editorial page editor in a decent sized metro?
Well, you meet, there's a morning meeting with your staff, and everybody's got their areas that they work on, and we talk about the issues of the day and who's doing what and sort of what's the most important, what should probably be placed in the paper the next day, and, you know, how quickly can we turn things around. And so it's just around the table kind of talking about the issues and some debate. I mean, there were lots of interesting debates, even though Frank Blethyn, the publisher, wasn't in the room. It was my job to kind of have a good handle on, you know, how far we could go down one road or the other. Frank was kind of mercurial about some things, but that was my job as the editor to balance that and make sure I was representing Frank's, what I thought were Frank's interests as best I could. So it's just, you're just talking about all the stuff that's going on in the city and the world and deciding what's going to appear in the paper over the next few days and constantly. I mean, every day there's a blank page to fill, so there's plenty of stuff to talk about.
Yeah. Well, you're working in the realm of ideas, that's for sure.
Yeah. When I hired a new assistant editorial page editor, I loved that what he said. It was great to be in the world of to chase ideas rather than fires. And that's exactly what it's like. Yeah, this is great. I never did like covering the copy. That was not my thing.
So, the journalism game has certainly changed a lot since you left it. It started changing maybe about the time you left, although we probably couldn't even have guessed 20 years ago the way the internet would decimate the advertising base of newspapers. But how's the Seattle Times doing now? What's your take on the
Well,
future of journalism?
they're surviving, but barely, just hanging on. I mean, they have gone to a model of they have some Microsoft money or they have to cover, I think, education. So they've carved out some coverage areas and have some arrangements with some. There's a lot of money, corporate money, to be had in Seattle. So, but they have very strict parameters so that money doesn't dictate the coverage. But so there's a lot of trust that has to go on between the editors and reporters and the top level management and the corporate executives. But that's worked for them in several fields. But it's just getting harder and harder in this pandemic when everybody working from home is, just I don't know. They're going to survive or not. The PI hasn't. It's just a kind of a. I guess
Online
there's some
thing now.
online version, but I sort of had a hint. I mean, it was beginning to happen. I'd set my timing that I, really wanted to follow through on this idea that Bill and I had to come to Sandpoint. And so I just set that date. And as things went along a couple of years earlier, hadn't told anybody else about it, but as things were going along, I was thinking, oh, this is a really good time to get out because, pretty soon there's going to be a whole new computer system to learn and all this online stuff was starting to happen. So, I'm not, very good at that kind of stuff. So it was good. It was good timing for me. And I really, the whole thing about coming to Sandpoint was I really liked, we liked this area and I wanted to leave journalism and be able to do in a small town that I cared about the kinds of things you can't do if you're a journalist. It's hands off. Instead of hands off, I wanted to kind of be embrace the things I cared about in the community. So that was my main motivation for leaving the job early. I mean, I was making good money and could have continued there another, bunch of years, but we just did what we wanted to do.
Well, I want to ask some questions just about the creative writing process and getting published. But before we do that and kind of turn away from what the book's about, there's a lot of reflection in it. It's a memoir. You would expect that. You reflect on the choices you make. And at one point in the book, you say, this book is about choices. And it's the type of choices that women face today or people face today. Any regrets on the choices you made?
No, not. I mean, sometimes when I, when Tim is reacting and still, part
A
of it is
younger
that
son,
scene.
yeah.
Yeah, my youngest son. There's a scene in the book that is hurtful for him, but he didn't ask me not to include it, and so I kind of have a little twinge of regret, but not really. I mean, I just felt like I'd read a lot of women's memoirs and had been inspired by some of them. And I just, not that this is, I'm putting this out there as an inspiring story, but it's just my story. And I think in the personal, there is so much that is universal. And I like these personal stories. I've read a lot of them. I like to see the voice of the writer in it. I tried to do that. So I would say, no, I don't really have any regrets about either the choices or writing the book.
Okay, well, that's kind of a good segue. What was your prime motivation to write this personal story?
Well, I think, as I said, I'd read a lot of memoirs and occasionally was inspired by some and I just kind of filed that away, just started reading more memoirs and kind of moved away from novels for a while. And at some point after, it was during the retirement years, and I'd done these things in Sandpoint that mattered a lot to me, and I decided, oh, I think I'm gonna be tired of that, turn that over to other people. And this back of my mind, this memoir thing, and I thought, I'd really like to try that. And so I got started. I started writing some things and showing them to some people, and they kind of, I don't know about that. And so I realized this was going to be harder than I thought. So I went to the MFA program, Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, to figure out what it means to write a memoir. I was pretty sure I had a story that was worth writing, but how do you organize it and how do you do it? So that was huge for me. It made it all possible. And I loved every minute of that whole program. It's just great.
Did you actually start writing the book while you were in that program?
I enrolled in the program and was very upfront about this I knew what the program elements were, and my whole goal and reason for doing this was to have a draft of my memoir be my thesis, the graduate thesis that you have to have when you get your degree after 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that's what I had. And then I spent the next, and so I graduated like 2 years ago, spent the next year and a half revising and rewriting and revising based on a lot of critiques I'd had during the program and a couple friends who read it carefully and offered me some really good advice that I think helped improve it a lot. So then I decided I'm not getting any younger. I'm just going to try and get this book out there. And so that's what I did.
And the publishing process, did you try to find a publisher that would take the book on?
I did. I started with looking agents, doing the agent pitches, and that wasn't getting me anywhere. And I started reading more about, well, what does it take? You know, they all have these secrets about your pitch letter and all of that. And then I finally decided I just wasn't, and all the things you need to have is a strong social media profile and blogger and all these kinds of things to sell your book. And because they're always want to make money off that book. And then they want you to write the next book. And I thought, that's just not me. And I'm too old to kind of go through all this stuff and wait forever to write 100 pitch letters or 200, like some people do before somebody discovers that I have a book worth selling. So I decided to do the self-publishing route, but I went to a company that helps people like me publish books that look and feel in a quality production and presentation sense like the other books that you see on the shelf. And I was very satisfied with that company. They have the designers for the cover, and I work with them on that, and I'm happy with how that came out and all the other pieces, the elements, setting your book up on the Amazon website and Ingram, which is the distributor of books, as you well know, nationally, and getting those business elements going. And they walked me through all of that. So it was very much worth it to me. What I didn't buy from them was the marketing package. So that's where I am now. And just, you know, calling influencers and doing all the things. You could probably help me a lot there, Chris, you know, marketing. Maybe I should hire you.
So that's the next part. Of your publishing journey here, mm-hmm. Is to figure out how do you connect with the audience that you think will be interested in your story and want to buy the book.
Yeah.
Do you have a plan there? May I ask?
Kind of. I mean, I did do a free webinar on the marketing thing and got some good suggestions there. So, and it's, you know, the one that really stuck with me is obviously do what you can on the social media platforms you're already on. And I'm on Facebook and Instagram, and I've been on LinkedIn, but I sort of kicked up my LinkedIn activity knowing that I was going to be in this point at some time. So I've done that. And then the other one was make a list of influencers, people you know that you want to know about the book because they have bigger social platforms than you do and they might be able to get it out. So that's been a combination of those things. And then I have the author books that I've bought and I've schlepped it around to all the bookstores in the region and sent some off to pals in Portland and Elliott Bay and Seattle. I haven't got any feedback, so I have no idea. And as you know, this pandemic makes marketing just a whole lot more difficult. I know at the bookstores, a couple of them, both locally and one in Coeur d'Alene, said it's really a shame we can't do readings and signings and that because mm-hmm. that's kind of another way to get it out there. So
really a primary way to the author to be out there talking about your book, and you're very mm-hmm. hamstrung with the current pandemic situation, unfortunately.
Right. So I've just kept kind of pushing it out there and I'm getting a few, you know, bites and hits. And so I just can't think of anything else really beyond that I can do right now. I've kind of covered all those bases, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, you definitely want to get it out to publications and we'll write about it. For instance, The Inlander had a short piece on it.
But the Inlander, I was writing book reviews for The Inlander, so I have a relationship there. And But then they shut that down because the pandemic, they just were losing a lot of money and they couldn't pay even the little freelancer amount that I'd still write for them if once I get past, you know, this whole focusing just on my own book, I'd still like to write some. I'd write it for nothing for them just to get some visibility out there because I like doing it. I just love reading and writing. The
Don't
book.
Tell Ted or he'll take you up on that. Well, we're about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your book or the experience of writing and publishing it?
Well, one thing I would say is as you said, the marketing thing is really hard, but it's kind of a joyful thing too because I'm proud of the book and I think it's pretty good, and I think it's worth wider attention that I hope to get over time. I'm gonna keep working on that, but the one thing that I was kind of surprised when it was finally I got word from the publishing outfit I was working with, well, my book is published, it's out there and it's available everywhere, and I saw, you know, the books that didn't have the sort of line across it that it's proof only.
Proof, right, yeah.
The real books, I mean, taking it down to Vandiford's and having them put it there in a display right front, it's, I hadn't imagined how thrilling that would be personally, but pleasing and satisfying it would be for me, so so it is. And I've had good luck. I mean, Marianne Love read it and did a really nice piece on her blog, and then this gal in Seattle has just put it on a online post in Seattle. So, I mean, I feel like it's kind of starting to happen a little bit.
So would your advice to somebody that's been thinking about writing a book be go after it?
Well, yeah. If you think you've got a story to tell, knowing that it takes a long time. It's not something you do in even a year or two. I've been probably now 5 or 6 years on this book altogether.
Yeah. Well, it's as you describe it, it sounds like it's very fulfilling to be able to tell your story and write a book, and it becomes a piece of literature. Who knows? 100 years from now, people could be reading this book and saying, "Wow, what was going on in 1965?" Mindy, so let's close out with just a couple of kind of anecdotal questions here. Okay. First of all, in your section where you talk about living back east in New York, it seems like you mentioned that you had a Pinto and that Bill had a Pinto. Were you really a two Pinto family?
Yeah, we were a two Pinto family. You know, we didn't have a lot of money back then. And we drove them, you know, across the country. So, yeah.
And they did okay for you.
They did okay. Yeah. I wouldn't want another one.
For younger listeners, a Pinto is a funny little car that came out by Ford. One more here. I have to ask this about Bill because he's charming, but is he sincere?
That's what all my friends who read it, you know, everybody picks up on that. I've been asking him this we've been married for 40 years and together for more years than that. And I keep asking, I said, now, is this for real? I mean, I know you're so charming. Is this sincere? And I guess so. In my case, he he's still with me.
Okay. I had to throw that in just for Bill's sake.
Yeah, good. I'll tell him.
Well, Mindy Cameron, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks, Chris. This was a lot of fun.
That's it for our show today. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY and our discussion with author Mindy Cameron on her new memoir, Leaving the Boys. I'm Chris Bessler. Be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more Community Conversations. If you happen to miss all or part of a show, remember you can hear the recorded podcast on our website at www.krfy.org and then click to our podcast page. Thank you for listening today.